I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and get your first month free. Just $1 down, $15 a month, no commitment. Deal ends Friday, February 13th. You coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Filmcast, a podcast about movies. I'm David Chen, and I feel pretty confident you guys are talking to 2026's Pulp Man of the Year. Joining me today is Devendra Hardwar.
I've also thought about murdering my enemies to win at capitalism. That's just the world we live in.
And Jeff Cannata.
I asked Dave if we were going to podcast again in 2026, and he said, yes, we have no other choice.
It's so true. Those are, of course, all vague and oblique references to the fact that today on the podcast, we're going to be reviewing Park Chan-wook's newest film, No Other Choice, which is out in theaters right now. I do want to mention, by the way, After Dark tie-in. Today on this week's After Dark, we are going to be discussing Park Chan-wook's horror thriller classic, Old Boy, which is something that's been in the works. And when I say in the works, I mean people have been waiting for it.
Horror is a bit much, but yes. Yeah.
Many, many years. Really? You don't think it's a horror thriller? Maybe
no.
Just thriller. How about thriller?
No. It's, thriller? It's a thriller.
Thriller,
it's a Hitchcockian
drama?
Hitchcockian thriller to the nth degree. Yeah.
I mean, Hitchcock made horror movies.
Yeah,
he did, but not all his thrillers were horror movies. Come
that's
on now.
True too. That's
you know
true
what
too.
A horror movie is.
Well, anyway, that is going to be at patreon.com/filmpodcast, where you can support us and get ad-free episodes, exclusive After Darks, including our review of Old Boy. Jeff Cannata's first time watching it.
That's right.
Really curious to hear what his reaction is going to be. You can find more episodes of the show at thefilmcast.com. Email us at filmcast@gmail.com. Today, we're going to be discussing some what we've been watching. Got a few weekly plugs for you. And then we are going to conclude with our review of No Other Choice. Couple of announcements to mention at the top of the show. First of all, I did just want to acknowledge the last episode that we recorded. Devendra and I recorded an episode acknowledging the tragic passing of the original co-host of what is now the Filmcast, Adam Quigley. And I just wanted to take a moment and say thank you to everyone who shared their kind remembrances of Adam. Mm-hmm. The only reason that episode was recorded and published is because we wanted to give Adam's family some sense of how beloved Adam was. I don't think they really understood how many lives he touched with his work on this podcast and through other channels. And I wanted to just say thanks to everyone who shared something. I've passed on many of the kind sentiments to the family, and they are very grateful for it. So, I also just wanted to take a moment to acknowledge Jeff Cannata, who is here today and took over for Adam many years ago when Adam left the show. Jeff, you didn't really have much of an opportunity to work with Adam, but we did all podcast together a few times, right?
We did, yes. We met in person at Comic-Con at least once, maybe twice.
I remember, by the way, that was like such a... So this would be like 2009
wild.
Time period.
Yeah.
And Jeff Cannata was like the celebrity for us at the time. Because it's like... Because the Totally Rad Show, they had the panel, right? And it's like a packed mm-hmm. room. And yeah. we're like, I don't think if the Slash Filmcast did a panel, like we would have a packed room. So the fact that you guys were like, you know... You had your own video show and packed panel room at Comic-Con. It was like, yeah. Ooh, wow. Like, that's what we one day aspire to be, you know?
So well, how things have changed.
How the turntables,
I don't
Jeff.
Feel that reverence today. What happened, Dave?
But it was wonderful, you know, the three of us kind yeah. of like going there, like me, Adam, and Devendra kind of going there and like kind of entering your world a little bit that you were already kind of a part of, right?
Man, what a magical time that was.
Yeah.
And you know, getting to meet the three of you and Peter Cerretta and yeah, like I said, you know, like you mentioned, I didn't know Adam well, but every interaction that I had with him was warm and delightful. And it is extremely sad that he has passed on. And I certainly wish his family all of my condolences. And it has been wonderful to see so many people send messages, post things in the Slack Filmcast, and talk with such such heart about the early days of this show and how much Adam's contributions and particular point of view helped shape their love that has kept them around to this very day. You know, that's yeah. a lot of years.
Yes.
That's
yes.
a lot of years to still be listening to the same podcast. And it's only because the three of you guys started it before I was ever around. And I'm indebted to Adam for that and indebted to you guys and very sad to have to hear about the circumstances of his passing. It's just really sad.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, again, just wanted to say thank you for all the kind sentiments that people have sent our way. And if you want to have a deeper understanding of the situation and our thoughts on it, I'd encourage people to check out that last episode. Always hard to transition on from news like that, but I am going to press on regardless and talk about a couple of other things going on in the world right now. In general, we don't talk about the Golden Globes because I find them to be creatively and artistically bankrupt. But Jeff Cannata, Nikki Glaser did do the hosting at the Golden Globes this year. And there was a joke.
Big fan of her. Yeah.
She did a great job. And she did tell a joke that I thought you would really appreciate. Okay. Because she basically said, she was doing her opening monologue, acknowledged all the actors that were there, and said, hey, The Rock is here for the Smashing Machine. The Rock is really lucky that the paper didn't get nominated for anything. Otherwise, you'd have no chance of winning.
That's so good.
And I just thought you might enjoy that one. Speaking of big events, Devendra, you were traveling the last week. You went to CES, the Consumer Electronics Show, which is the big confab where electronics companies show off what they think is the future of electronics.
Yeah.
And
Hell on Earth is what I call it. But, you know,
well,
being in Vegas
thing,
for a week.
It's a good thing your livelihood doesn't depend on you covering that industry.
Yeah.
But what did you see, Devendra? Tell us a little bit about some of the stuff that you saw.
I think, as usual, I saw lots of TVs. But the big thing, I think I mentioned this a couple episodes ago, but the big thing this year is micro RGB TVs. And it is an interesting development. So... going to throw a lot of acronyms at you guys. So right now we've got OLED, which everybody knows and loves with the pure blacks and everything. And we have mini LED TVs, which are sort of elevated LCDs that have a lot of backlights and sort of approach the quality of OLED. Don't quite make it, but they're very bright, often very brighter than OLED. Yeah. So micro RGB is an evolution of the mini LED technology with a lot more colors. They basically figured out how to put like RGB backlights on these things. So it's still LCD, They look very good. They're more color accurate than any screens we've seen before. And both LG and Samsung had those out there, and they had like freaking 130-inch sets on display, and they're just kind of amazing. So giant, big-ass TVs, like where we're approaching it. Certainly, Jeff, you're living that 100-inch TV life, right? Like,
yeah, you're saying it's a perfect time for me to have just bought a new TV that isn't that technology?
This is your timing. Your timing, as always,
did that,
Jeff.
Did that ever happen? Did you get the 100-inch TV?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, how is it? How is it? And it was not OLED. You did not get 100-inch OLED.
No.
It was just a...
No, God, yeah. No.
You got the QLED.
I don't got 100-inch OLED money.
Yeah. No. That'd be like $8,000 or $15,000 or something.
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah, they are getting cheaper, but not cheap enough for the old Jeff Meister. I will tell you how it's going in that we have a neighbor who is about a block away from us behind our house.
And they can see everything you're watching.
They called my wife and they're like, did you guys get a new television?
I'm trying to sleep at night. It's just blaring, exactly. Bursting through my windows.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So it's like the sun from Truman Show every day.
Yeah.
That sounds like a stirring endorsement to me. That sounds like everything I'd hoped for. It's like, neighbor a block away can watch what we're watching.
So you're a fan. You're a fan overall?
You're a fan of the gas.
I got the TCL. It's actually technically 98-inch television. It is a big step up from what I had been using, just in that the TV I'd been using is, I don't know how many years old now, 8 at least.
You had first-gen 4K, which means no HDR, none of the fun stuff that we really learned to love in the 4K sets.
I got to say, I think the thing that I most like about my new TV, and this is unique to me, so, you know, your mileage may vary, but the particular place that I have my TV in Colorado, we have lots of sun here. We have more days of sun than Los Angeles has. And it streams in through the window and it kind of bounces off the TV. And this micro LED, or sorry, not micro, what is it? Mini LED TV that I got has the sort of matte finish anti-gloss covering.
Nice.
Yeah. Oh, it's a huge improvement for just like, you know, afternoon viewing or daylight viewing when the sun is streaming in and bouncing off the TV. A massive difference in how viewable the television is.
Yeah. So, Devendra, your prediction is micro LED is going to be the tech of the future.
Micro RGB. So it gets even more confusing because micro RGB, evolution of mini LED, lots of colors. Lots of colors, really bright, big ass sets. Micro LED, that's a thing. That's a thing that's coming. That's the evolution of OLED. And that's basically higher quality, finer detail OLED as well. That looks amazing. Those sets exist. They cost like tens of thousands of dollars. The micro RGB sets may be like more expensive than OLED, but maybe not as much as a micro LED. So, you know, I saw a lot of good sets. I will say the most impressive thing I saw, though, was LG's wallpaper TV, which is just plain old OLED, but it is so freaking thin. It is as thin as a pencil. I'm like, you know what? I would be happy with that on my wall. Just that's the future. That's the future I was sold with sci-fi growing up. Super thin TV. No like cables in the back because it has like a wireless cable, you know, dock. So the only plug that comes out of it, the only cable that comes out of it is power. So you can hide that pretty easily. It's just like magical. So
all the connections, like HDMI, is wirelessly beamed to the TV.
From a box, anywhere else.
Because the OLEDs, the LG OLEDs, are already pretty thin. Like the LG OLED I have behind me is already about as thick as a pencil already. But the difference is you need to have a base. It's like,
and you have that whole like you have a bottom part that has all the processing and everything in it.
Right.
The wallpaper TV is just like thin all the way through, and that is ridiculous. So that's the thing I'm loving right now.
Well, we're glad you are back home, Devendra, and after having gotten a glimpse of the future, and we'll see if micro RGB and wallpaper thin OLED is the future. But according to you, it is. So, Devendra Hardwar, tech journalist, that's what he thinks is coming next. All right, folks, let us get to what we've been watching this week. Got a bunch of stuff to talk about. I wanted to talk about a new movie that is out on video on demand called Fackham Hall. Or as they
can't wait to watch this movie.
As they pronounce it in the movie, fuck them all. That's my British accent for you. Anyway, this is a Zucker Brothers style parody of movies like or shows like Downton Abbey, as well as Murder Mystery in there as well. Like Poirot, Agatha Christie, and Gosford Park, those kinds of things. And I have to say, I thought this was delightful. I have never seen a single episode of Downton Abbey, but this still worked on me. No, what? Yeah, I haven't seen a single
episode. I feel like we've talked about Downton Abbey.
I know.
I did put Downton Abbey very high on my summer movie wager one of the years I lost.
Yes, that's what you guys remember. I recall that.
I was betting.
I feel like Mr.
Oh, it's The Crown. The Crown.
Yeah, Mr. The Crown doesn't watch Downton Abbey?
No, yeah. The Crown's great. I have not seen Downton Abbey. But anyway.
The first two seasons of Downton Abbey are good. It goes, it leaps off a cliff after that. But the first two seasons are great.
I would not think that you could make a Zucker Brothers style parody of Downton Abbey. I wouldn't think that the humor would be there. The kind of ribald sort of body humor that you need to be capable of to make movies like Hot Shots and Naked Gun and Airplane would be there to make something like a Downton Abbey parody, but it is there. And what is great about this movie is the joke per minute ratio is great. It's like virtually one joke every shot. You know, there's a lot of visual jokes, a lot of like visual setups and gags, and I would say they had about a 60 to 70% hit rate, you know, which I think is actually very good. Like many things I'm laughing out loud, wordplay. And I think if you're really into Downton Abbey and Agatha Christie, I think you'll really enjoy Fackham Hall, which is available on video on demand. I just had a blast with this movie and would recommend it if you're looking for something delightful and fun. It is very graphic. You know, it is. I wouldn't necessarily watch it with kids. There is a lot of adult content in it.
You wouldn't watch Fuck'em All with kids?
I wouldn't say you should give kids the Fuck'em All treatment. I really think that this caught me by surprise. Because here's the thing that's so weird is when you watch a trailer for a movie like this, it can look like the stupidest thing ever made, right?
Oh, I want it to be the stupidest thing ever made.
But like the jokes that don't work in the trailer, like in the trailer, you're watching these jokes in isolation. Like you can't really get a sense of the overall tone of the piece. But when you watch it in context, I think it worked a lot better. I watched the trailer. I was like, that looks like it could be okay. And then I watched the movie and it totally worked. I think because in the movie, everyone's playing it totally straight, right? Like everyone is playing it like they're in the most serious drama of all time. And then in the trailer, they're just showing the gag. So then you're only seeing the silly things. But you need the tone to be dead serious for this movie to work. And it does.
Stupidity is the point with movies like this. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Stupidity is what you want. You know, Don't Call Me Shirley is a stupid, stupid joke, but it's beautiful. You know,
There's like a joke in the trailer where a detective shows up and he says, you know, I'm here for the murder of so-and-so. And then the butler says, well, I'm sorry, somebody's already done that, you know, or somebody's already committed it. You know, that's the kind of, you know, wordplay humor that you'll get. Yeah. So, Jeff, I think you'll get a lot out of this.
I'm so looking forward to watching
Jeff Canonometer has been so, so terrible in the last 6 to 12 months. But
this feels like a home run.
I mean, if it's not, then I don't know you anymore, which is a very distinct possibility. But anyway, Fuck'em All or Fackham Hall is available on video on demand. And I had a blast with that movie. Devinder Hardwar, hit us up with something you watched this week.
Sure. I've been watching season 4 of Industry. I think one of HBO Max's most undersung shows, but one of its best. And certainly after Succession ended, like if you want to a really nihilistic show about, greedy and cynical people that's also deliriously entertaining. Industry is that show. And this is a show that's like evolved over time. Season 1 was kind of rough, but I think there was a good template for it. The creators were like former investment bankers who had never written a show before, Mickey Down and Conrad Kay. And the first season is them just like trying to figure out how to build a TV show. but they create these really interesting young characters. There's a lot of great, interesting relationship dynamics in the show. So by season four, characters have leveled up. They've evolved. They also know how to make a better TV show now. So it's about investment bankers and a group of people who came up together, but it's also about, you know, what are they willing to give up while they chase power. And I still think Harper Stern, the character played by Mahala Harold, is just one of the most fascinating characters on TV right now. Like, people are talking about Marty Supreme, but she's over here. She is a wrecking ball of like pure chaos in a way that is, I think, more fun to watch for me. So if you enjoy that sort of thing, she also has this really interesting dynamic with her boss, Ken Leung, who's not her boss by season four, but they still have like really interesting dynamic. And by this point, the show has gotten to the point where like people want to be on industry. So like Cal Penn is in the season, Kiernan Shipka. Who else is here? Max Minghella, Charlie Heaton from Stranger Days is up here. And also Jon Snow himself was in last season. He's playing a big role in this season. So I think that's really elevated like the sort of publicity that the show is getting. It's still really good. You know, there's still a lot of like sex and people being like complete assholes to each other, but it's also one of those rare shows where like every scene just feels electric and these characters feel so well written and so dynamic, and the actors kind of know what they're doing. The writers are like always making interesting choices for them. Industry, check it out. It's one of the best shows on TV right now. Season four just began, but each season is like only eight episodes long. So you could catch up pretty easily. Get through season one, because by the time you get to season two, season three, like things really start cooking.
Yeah, this is one of those shows where I wish I loved it because I know it has a huge fan base and I would love to cover it in some way.
Did you watch any?
I tried to get through season one. I gave it a good effort, Devendra.
Okay. And then we never talked about it, so I don't know.
Everyone says like, oh, the season two, three are so much better. I got through like, I think like six episodes of season one. I was like, I can't do this. I'm not into this. But
I would have loved to talk about why it doesn't work for you, but it is very good.
No. I've heard season four is great, and so I'm glad people are enjoying it. That's Industry season four on HBO Max. Let's take a break for a sponsor. We'll be back with more what we've been watching right after this.
I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Jeff Cannata, hit us up with something you watched this week.
Well, I got a problem, guys, because all I watch now is the Taskmaster. It's a problem because I... You know, I wouldn't. Devendra will recommend Bosch, and I'm like, oh god, there's like how many seasons of that? I can't.
I'm so down the Bosch rabbit hole. I'm listening to Bosch the actor reading Bosch audiobooks right now. That's where I'm at. You guys got to start some real Boshing over here. Yeah.
That's the Kai Bosch, they call it. So you guys will recommend it. And I'm like, there's so many seasons. I couldn't possibly. Now, here's Taskmaster that has like 100 hours of content. And I'm like, yes, every time I sit down, an hour of it. Just that's all I want to do is watch Taskmaster. All of season 19 I did. I'm on season 7 now with James Acaster. So funny. Oh god, it's good. Anyway, that's not what I'm gonna I can't. It's a problem because I need stuff to talk about this show. I can't just talk about Taskmaster every week, even though I want to. It's what I want to talk about. is I also introduced the kids. So here's how this happened.
Okay.
My son heard me do please because I can do that, and I don't know why. I just do it sometimes.
What was the context? What was the context?
I don't know. Something like, hey, clean your room. I can't please. And he wanted to figure out how to do that. And so he's been, trying to get.
Well, he's practicing.
Yeah.
Now, here's a question: did you have to practice? Like, did you have to work up to that, or did
of course,
you...
as a kid, yeah.
Oh, okay. So you were just
magically
born...
able to do that.
Well, yeah. I don't know if you have a natural talent. You're just born with it, potentially. You know.
Well,
like,
I mean, obviously
we had nothing to do back in the day. Except
that's right.
So you're loosening your cheek.
That's what I tell
issue.
My kids is, you have screens all the time. I had weird that's why I can do a Donald Duck voice. Mm-hmm. It's why I can juggle, I didn't have things.
Yeah.
To do.
So you spent, I'm going to say, years loosening your cheek connective tissue so that you could do that.
Please, yeah. Eddie. I would just do that all the time.
Yeah, and now the sins of the father have passed to the son.
That's exactly right.
Yes.
That's exactly right.
All right.
Anyway, so he's gotten pretty good about doing that. No context for it whatsoever.
Uh-huh.
So I said, all right, we're going to sit down. We're going to watch Who Framed Roger Rabbit. I have not seen Who Framed Roger Rabbit in 20 years at least, maybe 30 years. I haven't seen that movie just all the way through. But I love that movie. I remember loving that movie. So we sat down as a family and we all watched the PG rated Who Framed Roger Rabbit. It's a lot racier movie than I remember.
I was going to say,
starts
dude,
racy.
Like,
it starts racy.
Racy all the way through, dude.
Yeah. I was going to say, racy. Like, not sure if, I mean, I will
PG.
Say, sometimes on a rare occasion, Jeff Cannata has texted me and said, if I've seen a movie in events, I'll say, hey, like, Dave, is this, do you think X, like, blank movie is going to be okay to take my family to see? And I'm like, oh, well, I don't know. Somebody gets in danger for like 5 seconds and feels really scared about it. Maybe you shouldn't take your kids to see it. Meanwhile, you're freaking letting your kids watch Who Framed Roger Rabbit without consulting the podcast.
I remember it was PG. I remember it being,
kids
I remember
movie.
It being, yeah. It was 1988 it came out, which means I was, sad to say, 12 years old. So a little older than my son and daughter. So maybe I was a little more ready for it. I don't remember it being racy. It's pretty racy. I mean,
it's racy, and there's at least one
the
really scary
one thing
part.
I remember yes. about it. Honestly. Yes.
I was worried it was going to be a little scary because, what's his name? Doc Brown. What's his
back? Christopher Lloyd.
Christopher Lloyd, yeah. Thank you. It's pretty scary in it. And, and there's the like acid killing of cartoons.
The dip, it's called.
The dip.
The dip. Yeah. That's right. That's what I was worried about, is that was gonna be a little that's not the part I started worrying about. The premise of the show is everyone thinks Roger Rabbit's wife is fucking someone else. Like, that's the whole premise of the show. And they get pictures of them playing patty cake together, right? Which is clearly a euphemism for something more. But, like, when he's behind the door, first of all, Bob Hoskins is, like, oogling Jessica Rabbit the whole time. He goes to a, like, strip show with her. It's pretty racy.
He is all of us. And also, how great was Bob Hoskins for just giving his all for these crazy roles?
He's
so good.
Freaking icon, that dude.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And Jessica Rabbit, I mean, obviously, I'm not bad. I was just drawn that way. I knew that she was, but I didn't remember how much the movie leans into that. It's pervy, dude. The movie's pervy.
Yes.
Way more
but
than
society
I
was pervy back
it
then.
It was a
too,
different
like,
time.
In general.
It was a different time. It was all fun and games.
I am stunned that you're stunned. Like, it's
I haven't
like,
watched the movie in 30 years, Dave.
First of all, neither have I. That is the number one thing. If you were like, hey, to use a word to describe Who Framed Roger Rabbit, racy is one of the top words. Probably the one.
Well,
word.
I'm an idiot then, and a bad
but also,
father.
Mickey Mouse is in that.
Yes.
Bugs Bunny is in that. How
exactly.
racy could it be?
It is rated PG for kids. It's like a kids movie on Disney Plus. It's kids movie.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair.
Yes.
They should put some warnings on that shit.
That movie should be PG-13, I
yes,
think.
Absolutely.
But like, absolutely. She walks by a dude and he smacks her ass. Betty Boop mm-hmm. is like, whatever.
Yep. Yep.
It's racier than I recalled it being. That said, that movie is still a masterpiece.
Mm-hmm.
And what a time capsule of a very specific slice of a moment in time before CG visual effects.
Mm-hmm.
Like, absolutely nothing in that movie would be done the way they do it in that movie today.
Yeah.
Not one visual effect, not one special effect that they do in that movie would be done the same way. Not one thing. And it's crazy. Like, it is a magical, the fact that they built rigging to like shoot water, real water out, that every right. time a tune touches something real in the real world,
yeah,
that thing was real. And they had a, you know, they painted over rigging that moved shit around. They built stuff inside Bob Costume's cloak so it had moved and bulged and did the right things. Absolutely none of that would be done that way today. And it's amazing to watch it. It's amazing to see real water, like he's pushing Roger Rabbit down in the sink and water's splashing, and it's yeah. all real water. They built a thing to splash real water, and then they painted, you know, hand-drawn cell animation over the rigging that splashed the water. All of it would be done with CG today. All of it. And there's something that you feel about it, watching a cartoon character move something that is a physical object in the real world around. It's spectacular. And there will never be a movie made like that ever again.
Yeah.
Like, it is singular. Singular in its existence. I mean, I guess Cool World might be another one.
Space right. Jam. Space right. Jam. Roger Space Rabbit Jam. Walked so Space Jam could dunk. Come
let me
on.
Tell you. Let me tell you. My parents took me to see Cool World at my insistence.
Mistake.
And
that's a racy movie.
That was that's not a good idea. Movie. That was not a good idea. So,
I am in awe of the fact that Who Framed Roger Rabbit exists. And there is, you know, you brought up the fact that Mickey Mouse is in it. There's a mm-hmm. scene early on that still hits me and does not hit my kids, will not hit any generation ever again. But the moment he walks into the strip club, the bar, the speakeasy, and Donald Duck and Daffy Duck are playing a duet, dueling piano style on stage.
Mm.
That's Superman and Captain America. That's yeah. Batman mm-hmm. and Spider-Man yeah. on stage yeah. at the same time. To little kid Jeff, that was as impactful a meeting of the IP as had ever happened up to that point, right?
Yeah. This was the original Avengers in a way, yeah. but yeah.
It was like, you know, seismic to my little mm-hmm. brain that, like, you know, DC and Marvel or, you know, Apple and IBM or whatever two opposing forces you want were teamed up here. You know, it was extraordinary, and it still hit me rewatching it, that scene. And the scene's amazing. And again, it's Daffy Duck and Donald Duck playing real pianos that physically existed on that stage and are being destroyed and smashed and bashed together, and they're just animating something over it. Today, they would not do it that way. They would not have a real, actual, physical piano gigged up to break and move and play right. itself. It would all be CG, and it would be less than for it. And so, you know, I'm not sure showing it to a 9 and 7 year old these days. Although, you know, honestly, I don't know.
Yeah, how much. Well, that's a big question. Is what do they think about it, Jeff?
Yeah.
My daughter lost interest fast, but my son really, I think he was into it. I mean, I don't know if he was into Jessica Rabbit. Maybe. But you know, it's
those
an awesome
canon
movie.
Events. Yeah.
It's an awesome movie structurally as well, because it starts with the tunes in the real world and then transitions to the real person in the tune world, which is just a magical trend. When he goes through that tunnel into Toontown mm-hmm. is one of the great moments in cinema, right? He's on the cartoon cab, and they go from the tunnel, from the real world, into just utter chaos. And I think cartoons were different. Like, cartoons meant
right
loony things were like absolute chaos and wacky and you know. So the fact that like the movie embraced what it meant to be a cartoon, where, you know, they literally kill themselves for our entertainment, you know, it's just, there's just nothing like Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and there never will be. And that's amazing. It's a really fun movie to revisit. It was one of the first things we watched on my new big TV. It was fun. So I really enjoyed revisiting it, although I, you know, clearly goofed a bit in judging the age range it's appropriate for.
This is what it was sold for, but yeah.
It's true. It's true.
I mean, look, all of us watched it when we were kids, right? So it's like,
we're okay.
Yeah. So, and we all turned out not horribly damaged by that.
Right. Everybody our age in the world is just a decent human being.
There were zero downsides to exposing us to mature content at such a young age. So, well, Jeff, I'm glad you got to bond with your kids over something that like was a big milestone for your youth. You know, that's always nice. So, Who Framed Roger Rabbit on Disney Plus, something Jeff Cannata has been watching this week. I had a chance to watch I'm Chevy Chase and You're Not, which aired on CNN on New Year's Day, and then will be on HBO Max later on this month. This is a documentary about Chevy Chase, and I don't know, guys. This movie has gotten pretty decent reviews. I am not so much of a fan of it. Marina Zenovich directed the documentary. Very talented director, in my opinion. I've watched a lot of her work. And, you know, I think she's done some good stuff. She chronicles a lot of people. She did a direct, she's done documentaries on people like Richard Pryor and Robin Williams. And I think she's a very competent filmmaker. One of the first ones I remember watching from her was Roman Polanski, the documentary about Roman Polanski, Wanted and Desired, which I actually was kind of formative for me. That movie came out in 2008. And so it was kind of like part of my upbringing as a film observer was watching that movie. And so like I have a lot of respect for her. I was watching this movie hoping to gain a deeper understanding of Chevy Chase. And at the end of this hour and 40 minute documentary, I do not feel like I really have done that. I think that there's a couple of issues. Number one, Chevy Chase is somebody who appears to have virtually no self-awareness, as far as I can tell, and is unable to kind of speak thoughtfully in general. It's not like always, but like in general is unable to speak thoughtfully about himself, his work, and how he's perceived by others. And number two, I saw this Letterboxd review that, I'm sorry, I don't remember the person, but like they put it really well. they said something like, it's like documentary jazz, man. It's all the interviews you're not seeing. because essentially a lot of people refuse to talk to the director for this interview, for this project, right? They're like, they hate Chevy Chase, and they're like, I'm not going to be part of this documentary, because I think they perceive, rightfully so, that one of the objectives of a documentary like I'm Chevy Chase and You're Not is to humanize this figure. Right, is to make it like, hey, this guy you've heard a lot about, who's like really, he's just a dude like you and me. He puts his pants on one leg at a time, like you and me, you know.
And or he has certain things that have contributed to his behavior.
Absolutely, we can
gain some understanding as to why he's the way he is, and maybe we should have some sympathy for that instead.
Absolutely. And disdain. First of all, there is some of that, Jeff, in the documentary. Yeah. So it's not like there's none of that in the documentary. There is some of that. But you can imagine if you had some of the worst working experiences you've ever had with somebody, like you wouldn't want to be part of that project.
Turned down the Dave Chen documentary.
Oh man, I'm sorry, dude. I meant to talk to you about that. Like, what was up with that, dude? That's not cool.
I mean, anyway. You know.
Yeah. No, I get it. I get it. I
was just busy that week.
It's understandable. I mean, Jeff, it was open. It was we were willing to work around your schedule, so I don't know why you said that.
My schedule is so complicated.
So it's all the interviews you don't see. You know, like, that's the thing. It's like there's a lot of interviews that are like, oh, that it would be extremely logical at this point of the documentary to have an interview with this person. And you don't.
The entire cast of Community.
Yeah, the entire cast of Community. Yeah. And, you know, Chevy Chase is getting on in years. And, like, I think part of a documentary, part of why he would participate in a documentary like this is to, you know, this is, I would suppose that people like Chevy Chase and Eddie Murphy and Arnold Schwarzenegger, these people that were huge in our childhoods, right? They are probably starting to think about legacy, how they'll be remembered. And so they participate in these documentaries, these like fairly soft focused, softball style documentaries as a way of portraying themselves in a mostly positive light.
Is that how you felt this documentary was slanted?
Yes. Yeah. That's me personally. Other people might disagree. So, I mean,
because all I've seen, you know, I'm very much looking forward to watching this. But all I have seen about it is people pulling stuff that make him look like an enormous asshole, which is not hard with Chevy Chase. But
yeah,
you know,
yeah. I mean, to be fair, there is some of that in the documentary. I mean, my favorite is right at the very beginning when he says to the documentarian, "I don't think you're bright enough to make a good documentary about me."
Oh, you sugarcoated that. The way he says it is way worse.
Yeah, yeah.
Way worse than the way you put it.
It's very acid. Yeah. It's very like combative.
It's, yes. It's cold. It's
right.
It's meant to be a dagger. And mm-hmm. yeah. It's,
but I guess I come away with it like I have some understanding of why he is the way he was a little bit, you know, like maybe 10% more. Mm-hmm. I have some understanding of the flavor of how difficult he was, but I don't know that I have particularly that much insight into it. And it's because I don't think he has great self-awareness and a lot of people didn't talk on the camera. And mm-hmm. I think that's, those are big problems that the documentary struggles to overcome. Mm-hmm. Somebody did have insight that I thought was really good in the documentary. They said, you know, because let's pause for a moment, guys. Chevy Chase was a massive deal at one point in time, right? Like,
I mean, that he was the biggest movie star in the world.
One of the biggest movie stars in the world, right? Like, he was obviously Saturday Night Live, Three Amigos, Fletch, you know,
like, all the vacation movies,
All the vacation movies, National Lampoon's vacation movies, and was huge, just huge. And then somebody in the documentary said, you know, if this guy was this much of an asshole on the way up, you can imagine what it was like on the way down. And then it does chronicle like a lot of his failures, including the Chevy Chase show, mm-hmm. which lasted for around 5 or 6 weeks. And do you guys remember that? I remember watching the Chevy Chase show
on its existence.
When it aired. Do you remember this?
That was the talk show he did.
The talk show he did that lasted
which everyone, it was as combative as he is just as a, imagine going on a talk show and the talk show host hates you and doesn't want to talk to you.
He was doing Between Two Ferns, but for real.
Yeah. Right. Between Two Ferns, but for real. Right. But also like one thing I thought was interesting was the skills of being an on-screen talent are quite different than the skills necessary for being a talk show host.
Absolutely.
I think people just assume, oh, this guy's good on screen. People like this guy on screen. Like, of course he can talk to people. Of course he can do a monologue. And they were wrong. You know, like it's just a completely different skill set. And that's how coked out people were in the 80s and 90s. It's like they had these wild ideas. Charlie Sheen can do a tour. That's going to work. Yeah. You know, that was,
I think
later
that just happened 90s. Actually.
Yeah. That actually just happened. Yeah. So anyway, it's a decent overview. And I think there is inherent value in seeing a star that massive talk about their career. Like no matter how uninsightful the documentary is overall, like just seeing a guy at that age towards the end of his life and career, talk about his career, that has some value. Does it need to be a you know, 2 hour long documentary or 1 hour, 45 minute documentary. Maybe, you know, maybe it could be a 6 episode podcast and that would be better. I don't know. Who knows? But then many people wouldn't watch it, but regardless, or listen to it. Regardless, I thought this movie was fairly dissatisfying. But if you're really hungry for Chevy Chase content, it's not too bad. It's not too bad. It's Chevy Chase and you're not. And again, it will be on HBO Max later this month. Let's take another break for a sponsor. We'll be back with more what we've been watching right after this.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Divin, your hardware. Hit us up with something you're watching.
Yeah, I've been checking out the second season of The Pitt, which continues to be very, very good. They're still going with the sort of like 24 format where the entire season is going to cover a day. This particular day is July 4th, I believe, of this year.
Correct.
And we're watching the people, the folks who like basically just started at the hospital are now in their second years or at least more experienced years. Noah Wiley's character, Dr. Robbie, is about to go on sabbatical. So it's another like all these stories that happen before a big moment in his life, right? This will be an uneventful day.
This guy is the Jack Bauer of ER doctors. Like every season seriously. Is like the most catastrophic day ever.
Is it just a bunch of people losing fingies? Is it just all 4th of July
oh,
problems?
They lose many things.
Let's hope that's what it is, Jeff. Jeff, did you watch any of Pitt season one?
I watched the first episode and peaced the fuck out.
I've watched the Pitt season one. I've watched Pitt season two premiere. It's a wonderful show. It's
so good.
I recognize it's good. I'm just too squeamish to watch it.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is one of those shows that makes you realize like doctors and especially ER doctors, they're just a different breed, breed of people who has to deal with like some of the grossest and craziest aspects of humanity and the human body. And this is Tuesday for them. Right. So it is.
Nope.
It gives me more respect for those folks. Given how crazy things go in this show, and from what I can remember in ER, the thing about it is that this is on HBO Max, so they can go full gore, they can go full insanity, and not much actually happens in this first episode, but it does set up a couple of things that are really interesting. I have to say, somehow, this show just finds the most beautiful actresses around. I don't know how they keep doing it, but that's the thing about The Pitt. Also, this episode starts with Noah Wiley driving his motorcycle like down, like speeding past ambulances and stuff. No helmet. And I feel like if there's one lesson you get from any show about ERs is wear a fucking helmet.
Yeah. If you're an ER doc, I feel like you're more akin, you know, more tuned to that.
It's almost like characters are complicated and aren't always internally consistent with themselves.
I know. It's certainly like a character trait, but it's also like it tells you something about that character.
That's right.
It tells you something about him as a person. But also, wear a fucking helmet. We
have no helmet law here in Colorado, and it's insane to me how often I see dudes with no helmet on. And there's like, you'll drive by, you know how you have those signs that will tell you, you know, like, don't drink and drive, or like it has a thing. There's signs in Colorado they'll put up on them how many deaths there's been from people not wearing helmets, and people just ignore that shit. It's crazy to me.
Where I will agree with you, Devendra, is I do think he looks a little too cool in the opening scene. Like, you know, they should make it.
It really does glorify.
They should not make it aspirational. to be riding around without a helmet.
Or at least somebody should call him out on it within the show.
Yeah, yeah. It's okay if it's part of the character and he's a complicated dude. I get that. That's good. But they should not make it look cool, which they kind of do.
Because he looks so cool.
Because he looks cool.
It does look cool. But anyway.
He looks like a rebel. He looks like a little bit of a rebel.
He looks like a rebel. Nobody can tell the no rules. He's the ER doctor who does not follow the rules of his superiors and whatnot. It's a really well done show. I'm excited to see where the season goes. And season one was incredible. So if you missed out on The Pitt, now is a great time to catch up.
Yeah, and it really is people might think this is an insult, but I would say it is a television achievement on the scale of a 24.
Sure.
Where it's like, wow, how did they come up with something that is in real time? Every hour is 1 hour, and also is engaging all the way through. Like that is a huge accomplishment to be able to do that.
Yeah.
One of the reasons, by the way, they are able to make this show so frequently, because I think the last season was not even a year ago.
Yeah.
Is because they're saving money because the entire show is basically on one set. And so
it helps when you never leave that set.
Yeah. When you basically never leave that set. Now that's a downside of the show as well, because you know that like nothing can happen tomorrow in the show that you see. Right. If there's anything that needs to happen, quote unquote, tomorrow, you're not going to see it on the show, which is a bummer.
I do like how the show sort of answers. We would wonder in 24, when does Jack Bauer go to the bathroom? We're with him every minute of this day. Never tries to go to the bathroom. At multiple points in The Pitt, people are just trying to go to the bathroom.
Yeah, literally they're trying and failing to go to the bathroom. That is correct.
It's too busy. I can't take a piss, but it feels logically consistent.
24 was a story about how high stress situations make you constipated. That's what the subtext is.
And not need to pee either. So like,
not need to pee.
What is the opposite of incontinent? Continent? Is that what it is?
I'm
so continent today. Anyway, whatever it is. Okay. The Pitt season two. I agree. It's a wonderful show. Like I talked a little bit about this on Decoding TV, but basically I would have never thought that a pro-science, pro-medical science, pro-doctor, pro-medicine, pro-scientific method show would be something that is counterculture in America. But I do think that there is something mildly subversive about The Pitt. In that it is.
Did you see the flipped food pyramid now?
Yeah.
Everything's so stupid.
In that it celebrates doctors, it celebrates expertise, which is something that a lot of people are against these days. And so for that reason alone, I would recommend watching The Pitt, season two of which is now on HBO Max. All right, Devinder, let's do a couple last things. Speaking of HBO Max, I had a chance to watch the entire season of Heated Rivalry.
Oh, the whole thing. Okay.
At my wife's behest, she says, everyone's talking about this. We got to get in on this.
Yeah. She's like, I've watched how much garbage for you? We're watching Heated Rivalry. It's viral. Okay.
Heated Rivalry, you know, Devinger talked about this a couple weeks ago on the podcast, but Heated Rivalry, for those who don't know. I mean, Devinger, first of all, the path that this show took.
Amazing.
To exist is incredible. I think that it was the entire 6-hour first season was filmed over the course of, I think, like 30 to 40 days. Extremely compressed timeline. As of 2 months ago, HBO had not made a deal to acquire the rights to it. I think it was like in November when Casey Bloys was able to review Heated Rivalry and assess it for its value. And then it went on to HBO. It has become a massive sensation. Everyone knows about it. Everyone's talking about it. It is about two hockey players who fall in love, and it chronicles their relationship over the course of their heated rivalry and ups and downs in the hockey industry, question mark? What is it? Hockey field?
I don't know.
Anyway.
Sure.
Sport.
Sport?
It's a sport.
In the hockey sport? Anyway, I'll be honest. Took me a while to get into this one. I think there is just a lot of gay sex in the first 3 to 4 episodes.
I mentioned this.
Yeah, you mentioned
they really linger. They spend some time in there. Yeah,
a lot. It's a lot of gay sex, and at first I was like, man, when are they going to stop with the gay sex and start with the gay emotions? You know, which is kind of, that's more interesting to me. I think I know what gay sex looks like. Okay, guys, I don't need to see another 2 hours of gay sex. But
I feel like the first episode really, like, it gave you some things. It gave you some aspects of those characters in terms of how they may be alienated a little bit from this industry, from the sport they're in, also from the people around them, too. So,
right. I mean, the books were written as a response to the kind of casual homophobia in the sport of hockey. Mm-hmm. But that's the journey of the show, though, you see, because it starts with the lust and the passion. And then, and only when, like, the throes of that have kind of passed, does it then start to get at the emotional connection that may or may not result underneath all of that. And I was deeply moved by episodes 5 and 6 of the show, like weeping episodes 5 and 6 of the show. So, but yeah, there is a lot of extremely graphic gay sex to get through. And, you know, your appetite for the show may be informed by that in some way. But I overall, after having watched all 6 episodes, I understand what the big deal is. I understand what the big deal is. So if you are into this romance with these two hockey players and the struggles that they have to navigate.
Not just two hockey players, two of the most beautiful people to grace this earth. I'll put it that way too. Like that is part of the attraction of the show. It's like they're not just two dudes.
Yeah.
Two exceptionally gorgeous men. But yeah.
I just want to point out, by the way, like I think I would be saying the same thing if it was a heterosexual story and there was tons of heterosexual sex as well.
That's
like,
probably the thing I just want to make that clear. You off from, like, industry.
It's not like I have a aversion to gay sex specifically. It's like
just kind of a prude, this David Chen.
I'm just kind of a prude. I'm just,
just doesn't like industry. Sex.
Yeah. Well, let me put it this way. You know, now that we mentioned this, it's like I think that sex scenes should serve storytelling function, and some people might feel like they do in Heated Rivalry. I would say that it was a little bit more than I personally needed to understand the point that was being made. But I do think sex scenes are a very legitimate storytelling tool.
There is a value to the idea of smut. Like that's kind of like something being a little too much. And I don't know how much you engage in that, but hey, industry season 1 kind of delves into that a little bit when they didn't like have the writing set. They had weird, smutty sex scenes at times, and it's a bit of a turnoff. And then they kind of matured from there. But yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's many shows that kind of do this in a way that is off-putting to me. And it's not just homosexual sex. It's like in Game of Thrones, some have argued that like the amount of sex in that show is a little excessive. And so anyway, I just wanted to acknowledge that it's more of my general attitude towards sex scenes as a whole. And if they're like, if I feel like they're being used effectively for storytelling versus
now, brutal, horrific, unsolved murders. That's Dave Chen's alley.
Can't
right
get enough
there,
of that. But, can't get enough of that. You know, show me some more crime scenes. Cool with that. Can't do too much.
True
of that,
crime, so. Baby.
Yeah.
I do want to point out Valentina V, who is a cinematographer, has produced a lot of great videos exploring the craft of Heated Rivalry. And she does a great job of talking about like just how well shot the show is at times. Like it is not a lazy show. They shot quickly, but they have like a very specific filmmaking vision for Heated Rivalry. And her videos are making me want to go through the entire season because it does look well crafted.
Yeah. Absolutely. Love Valentina's work and possible future Decoding TV collaborator.
I hope so. She's great.
Show. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, check out Heated Rivalry. And as you want to say, like, overall, strong recommend on the show. And I get what the big deal is. And yeah, it made me very emotional. And there's a lot of like really powerful moments in the show. So Heated Rivalry, check it out. All right, Devendra, bring us home. One last thing for what we've been watching.
Yeah, I got to check out Alpha, which is a new film by Julia Ducournau. And listen, after you make a film like Raw, you have me for life. I will watch whatever you do, wherever you are. I've watched her episodes of Servant. We talked about Titan, her second film, which is kind of a wild thing that is very hard to explain. And Alpha is even a little more inexplicable than Titan, I'd say, from what I can tell, not nearly as beloved, hasn't been reviewed that well. And I thought it was like, it's really compelling. Julia DeCarno, I think, is one of the most exciting filmmakers right now. There's a smash cut edit at the beginning of this movie that goes from like a ladybug fluttering on somebody's fingertip to the tip of a tattoo needle. And it's so jarring, but so sharp, and so like it hits so well. It feels like one of the things you expect from like a Scorsese movie or something. Just like the craft on display here is really, really good. Alpha is about a 13-year-old girl who lives with her mom. Her mom's played by Gulshifta Farahani, who I love. I've loved her in everything. She was in Patterson. She's been in those what are those movies? The Chris Hemsworth Netflix movies. I'm trying to think here now. Extraction. She's been in the Extraction movies. She's the like cool, tough girl in those things. She is fantastic here. And this is set in a world where like it's sort of like a response to the AIDS crisis. It's set in the world where there is some sort of like blood virus that everyone is afraid of. And it slowly turns people into stone. Sort of like stone statues. So society is sort of worried about that sort of contagion. But it also seems like a movie that was made, you know, amid COVID. Like this movie was made after COVID happened and after we all lived through it. And a lot of it also seems to be the way we process dealing with grief, dealing with the loss of people we love. It is juggling a lot of things. I don't think it's as fully successful. You know, I think Raw was an incredibly sharp, focused film that is a masterpiece of a debut. Titan was like a wild swing as a sophomore effort that was a little more crazy, a little harder to define, but I still think that's very intriguing. Alpha is just more out there, more scattered. It's not nearly as focused, but I will say her filmmaking is on point. And Tahar Rahim, the actor from, I believe, A Prophet, and we may remember him from Madame Web. He was the villain of Madame Web. Oh, yeah. Dude lost like 50 pounds to play an addict, the drug addict in this movie. And he looks insane. Like he does not look like the same person I've seen in all these other movies. He looks like he really took a real hit to his body to make this movie and make it very accurate too. So it is worth it for seeing his performance. It's worth it for Gulshifta Farahani. And like it is compelling, even if the pieces don't all quite add up. This is one of those movies that also jumps between time periods and is often unclear about how it does that. So that is kind of confusing narratively. And at some point, I feel like those two, the different time narratives kind of conjoin in a way, too, that is confusing because the rules are not fully laid out in this film. So it's a lot. It's messy. It's confusing. But I will say it is worth watching. That's Julia DeCarno's Alpha.
Alpha will apparently be out in limited release in March of 2026. Yes. So this review is coming 2.5 months early. But I agree with you, Devinger, that Julia DeCarno's work demands attention. I'm going to try to check this out. It was part of the Neon screener pack that many critics got at the end of the year. And Devinger thinks it's worth checking out. So Alpha is the name of the movie, and I look forward to watching it myself. Speaking of time jumps, by the way, man, like, heat of rivalry, dude. 15 time jumps in the first two episodes, which is
they get a little plot ticket through.
This is a wild number of time jumps. I think it's a high number of time jumps. Okay, was there not another way to tell that story? Okay, moving on. Let's get.
Sometimes the people in your life you meet at different moments and they mean different things to you. You know, yeah.
Let's get to weekly plugs. Weekly Plugs is a part of the show each week where we plug something else we've been making. Folks who subscribe to my personal Patreon at patreon.com/DaveChen may know that I record multiple podcasts on that Patreon that are exclusive to that show, that Patreon. But here's one that's not exclusive. David Chen's Year in Review. We did an episode with my wife and David Cho. We talked about every notable thing that's happened in my life in 2025. That is an episode that is free for everyone to listen to. If you click on the link, you can download, listen to it. Check it out. Patreon.com/DaveChen. It was a great conversation. It was very purifying to cover everything that kind of happened in 2025. It was a lot of stuff. And so if you're interested in what's going on in my life beyond just the stuff you hear on this podcast, patreon.com/DaveChen, and there's a link in the show notes. Devinder Hardwar, your weekly plug.
Yeah, check out all my work at Engadget. Like, I've been working nonstop for the past week at CES, so there's a lot of content, not just TVs. I looked at laptops. We had some great podcast episodes. We talked with the guy who created the Pebble Watch. He's back with a different like version of that Pebble Watch.
Wow. And an
AI smart ring that may actually be cool. Like, you hit a button and you can take a note. Just record a thought, transcribe a thought. That's all it does. It doesn't track anything. It doesn't do anything else. So there's a lot of cool stuff that we saw. Check it all out. All my stuff is a Engadget.
Jeff Cannata, your weekly plug.
And remember the Pebble Watch? Wow. What a time. What a time.
I literally purchased one at the time.
Yes. And you can buy them again. They're coming back.
Kickstarter was like the first big Kickstarter thing.
Oh, yeah.
The DLC podcast, my video game podcast, is back for our 13th year doing video game stuff. And the first two episodes of 2026 were pretty darn fun. Episode 633 with Ashley Esqueda and episode 634 with Alan Brooks are both available at dlcpod.com. Having fun, man. Having more fun talking about video games. If you like video games, the video game industry, this will keep you up to date on the news that's happening, all the games we're playing. It's fun. It's irreverent. It's a good time. Christian Spicer is my co-host. Check it out, dlcpod.com.
You know, all of this talk about weekly plugs makes me remember, like, guys, I don't know if you guys know this. I got fired from the calendar factory recently. I just want you to know, I got fired from the calendar factory. Just a random fact. All right. Anyway, patreon.com/filmpodcast. is where you can get ad-free episodes, exclusive access episodes, and bonus episodes. Check it out. Thanks to everyone at patreon.com/filmpodcast who makes this podcast possible. Of course, we never want you to donate if it in any way causes you financial hardship. You can only support us for free by leaving a star rating for us on Apple Podcasts. Just takes a few seconds of your time, and it helps a lot. Thanks to everyone who does that as well. Let's get to our review of No Other Choice. It was because I took too many days off.
Wow.
It was because I took too many days off.
This podcast is free, folks.
I think that's one of the better ones.
Thank you, Jeff. Welcome to the Filmcast review of No Other Choice, the new movie by Park Chan-wook. I'm going to read the plot summary from IMDb. After being unemployed for several years, a man devises a unique plan to secure a new job, eliminate his competition. Now, Devinder Hardwar, you and I have been huge Park Chan-wook fans for decades.
Yes.
Now, decades. I think I remember watching...
He is probably one of the reasons I fully fell in love with film, you know?
Yes. Yeah. I think I remember watching a very sketchy copy of Sympathy for Lady Vengeance way back in the day. I mean, like, we're you know, Old Boy. I have the Tartan Blu-ray release of Old Boy from way back in the day. You know, like, we go all the way back. JSA and his early films as well. So a lot of interest in Park Chan-wook's latest, especially since it might be topical. Devinder Hardwar, what did you think of No Other Choice?
You know, I talked about this before. I think this movie is incredible. Like, it's an incredible... First of all, it's like just so entertaining and so fun and so well-made, but it's also, I think, a really fun satire of how far... the idea of like surviving and being successful within capitalism, within the framework of it, how far it will take you. It's a ton of fun, but also makes you think. You know, a friend of mine mentioned that it's sort of like what would happen if Hank Hill lost his job at the propane, you know, at the propane place and like just had to like become the best and recenter his place. It's about how much our identities are tied to work, how much our value and our self-worth is tied to it as well. And how much like that it is like we are built around this society that is, that's how we are defined, even without our choice, really. Like, this is just kind of the way you have to exist. It's so funny. It's so well made. And I just love watching a Park Chan-wook movie, even when it doesn't click for me. Like, it is the craft involved, the filmmaking involved, the way he transitions between scenes and shots is just a lot of fun. Watching his movies feels like going on an amusement park ride. Like, I just never know what I'm going to see, and I'm always entertained. I think this one is a lot of fun. It is funnier than the last one that we saw. So, but I
think decision to leave, right?
Yes. Which was also really well made and a lot of fun too. But that was less of a comedy. This one is more like a straight up sitcom at times, and it is just like really funny. It is also really, it's great to see like where he is right now, because I think early on as a filmmaker, like he was trying really hard to prove himself. I think a lot of his early work like lived in this like level of misery that maybe he was in. Like a lot of it could be described as like misery porn. I wasn't a huge fan of Mr. Vengeance, but like, you know, it's interesting like where he is now and what he finds interesting and how he's using his voice. And he's just like a lot more loose, a lot more like relaxed as a director, but also still like cranking out incredible bangers. So I love this movie, and I love this for him. I love that he is still like hitting it.
Jeff Cannata, your thoughts on No Other Choice?
Well, Dave, I guess you could say my thoughts on No Other Choice are best summed up in the form of a limerick.
Let's hear it, Jeff.
Myself as a pressure-strapped dad, I relate to the stresses he had. It lost me, though, with the lengths that he'll go. There's no joy in him breaking bad. I hate to keep bringing this up, but I feel like I had the reaction to this movie that you guys had to Marty Supreme. Which
we're done with Marty Supreme.
I don't want to relitigate Marty Supreme, but I feel like I had a similar reaction where it's like, man, the filmmaking in this movie is amazing, as it was in Decision to Leave, as it was in The Handmaid's Tale, as it was in all of the...
Mm-hmm. The Handmaiden, to be clear.
Excuse me. The Handmaiden. Handmaiden, yes. Yeah. Pardon me. All of Park Chan-wook's films that I've seen so far, I'm just astounded by the visual inventiveness, like where to put a camera, how to shoot this, how to use the angle and the movement of the camera to help tell the story in ways that are not, I think, immediately obvious, that feel, even the way the movie is edited, there are sequences that are sort of, out of sequence or disjointed, or
the transitions, I think, are all beautiful. Really excellent. Yeah. Can I give an example, Jeff? Is that okay?
You may.
At the very beginning of the film, there's this beautiful moment when the main character is hugging his family, and it's like a lovely moment, and then literally transitions to everything washing down an industrial sink.
And most of them
cross dissolve into like washing down a sink, and it's like, well, oh, that's the whole movie right there, right? Like,
most of them are these insanely intricate graphic matches. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Where
yes.
it's like the shape of that thing is also the shape of that other thing.
Yep.
And that is extraordinarily different. Like the house is the same shape as something. It's like, well, how do you even get to that?
And he wants you to like think about like, how are these things connected? And are they connected in some way? Do they just look alike? You know, and you're thinking in a way that you're not thinking when you watch a normal movie.
Amazing. Right, there's a shot in the middle of the movie where the main character drinks from a bottle, and the camera is at the bottom of the bottle.
Yes.
And it lingers so long that you literally see his face as he drains the liquid, and he's still there, it framed perfectly. It's like, how many times did it take to just do that?
Yeah.
You know, it's extraordinary. And so the filmmaking is on another level, and I'm always astounded as we talk about Park Chan-wook movies. But I'm also always, I think, or at least the trend has been, as we've talked about his most recent films, is that I'm always sort of put off a little bit by the content, in that I think he, for me, and obviously this doesn't apply to everybody and certainly not you guys, but for me, I feel like it's just like one step too far sometimes, mm-hmm, where it just kind of hits the nail on the head a little too hard. And I feel like this movie overstays its welcome a bit for me, as many of his movies do. Like, they're just a little overlong and a little, like, at a certain point, it's like, this movie should have ended like 20 minutes ago, and I would have come away from it feeling, you know, I would have had to wrestle with how I feel rather than the movie like continuing to go on and really put me, put a punctuation on this that it didn't need. You know what I mean? And, you know, to my point about the sort of Marty Supreme of it all, like, I had a hard time rooting for this guy at any point. Like, his solution to the problem is so extreme and so dark and so, I think, misplaced that, you know, it, at a certain point, I'm just like, not down with this dude and his family. But I will say, Sun Yi Jin, who plays his wife, I think is the standout of this movie. Incredible. She is amazing. Yeah. I loved her, but it, you know, it bums me out that this movie kind of doesn't, well, I don't want to get into spoilers, but I think the end, you know, didn't love. And so much of it is so dark. And you're kind of asked to, like, understand. Like, fundamentally, it's called No Other Choice. And I don't think he had no other choice. You know what
I mean?
Like,
definitely not.
Yeah.
But it's about, like, the pressures. Like, he feels like he owes. You know?
I understand. Like, I'm just not down with it. I'm just not. At no point am I down with this dude's decision process. And I never feel like I'm inside his head. Or at least I just disagree with where his headspace is. And so it's harder for me to sort of be on board with this. And I kind of feel like that's what you guys were saying with Marty Supreme. And recognizing that I think the movie's extraordinary on a number of levels, and it's harrowing journey, and it's intense, and it's incredibly well made. So, you know, I have a lot of positive things to say about it, but ultimately, like all of his movies so far, I just felt like, man, we just push me. Yeah. I'm down with you, and you just kind of just push me over the cliff a little bit, you know?
I have a few thoughts, and then we can move to spoilers. I love this movie. I put it as my number 4 or 5 of 2025. It was an incredible movie. Did you also, put No Other Choice
on
your
top 10? Yeah.
Yeah, it was on your list as well. Yeah. One of my favorite films of 2025. I think, first of all, by the way, just a quick note, No Other Choice is said by many characters at many points during the course of this film. There's no other, hey, we had to fire you. No other choice. Of course we have to automate everything. Like, no other choice. Like, I have to do this. No other choice. It's like a constant refrain, at least in the subtitles. I don't know what it's like in the original Korean. So I just want to acknowledge that it's like multifaceted, the title. I love this movie because I think it captures a lot of the fundamental paradoxes of what it is to try to be a worker in this world. On the one hand, there is some joy and delight and something magical about being an expert at something. And I think, like, you see these guys, the way they talk about paper, everyone in this movie is a paper employee and a paper expert.
It's a real Dunder Mifflin universe.
Yeah, Dunder Mifflin. I mean, like, it could be any, like, there's nothing specifically about paper that is, but it's like, it could be about any industry, pencils, whatever. Like, but the point is that they love their jobs. They are interested in paper.
It's like the dude in High to Low that loves ladies' shoes. You know,
You know your craft, and there is value in knowing
high and low.
There's value in knowing your craft and the time and experience you put into it. Yeah,
right. And when they talk about it, it's with so much love and care, and there is something aspirational about it. There's something that actually legitimately feels good on a spiritual level, I would argue. Like, it's not just stuff that the job makes up. We're a big family. Here's pizzas on Fridays. Like, it's something that, like, oh, I can take pride in knowing a thing, in doing a thing well. There's something about the human condition that speaks to in a core way.
Can I dig down on that for just one second? I don't want to interrupt you, but I do think that's a really powerful part of this movie, and it reminds me of stuff that we've talked about a lot on my other podcast, DLC, with regard to the video game industry and the mass layoffs that are happening and have been happening over the last 3 to 5 years in the video game industry. And it's this loss of institutional knowledge, this loss of accumulated experience. Mm-hmm. And I think this movie speaks to that in a really powerful way as to what is actually lost when we move to automation, or you move, you know, or you lay off large swaths of the workforce that have been there for, you know, years and decades, and that have built up this institutional expertise that may not be measurable, may not be something that
not
you can
make. It may not directly make line go up.
That's right.
Right. But there's something to it that is actually important. Part of the core of whatever this company does, that's lost when you get rid of them, when it's automated away, and so on.
Yeah.
Jeff, did you? I texted you this article about dictionaries. Do you remember that? Did you get that article?
When was this?
This is. I was on vacation last week, and I texted you an article about dictionaries. Anyway, Jeff Cannata loves words.
I do.
And there was an article I texted Jeff about dictionaries, and how they're going out of style. Like they're going out of style. They're dying. There are
I can't even buy them. I'm trying to buy one. Yeah.
But at one point there were like hundreds of what are called like lexicographers or lexographers in the country. And now there might be like 30 of them, you know, like in the whole country. It's like not the job of like knowing what words people use is no longer important anymore. And so there's many such cases of like
more than that. Sorry. I don't mean to interrupt again, but it's like you've triggered me because the way dictionaries were written was an art form. And and now a dictionary is just this hyperlinked collection of you know, kind of bland, banal links to other words, And I've been, by the way, when I went to London with my family, my mission was to buy an old dictionary. That was what I stated. And I went into so many bookstores in London trying to find an old dictionary, could not find a good one. If you buy a like turn of the century, the 20th century dictionary, or like early 20th century dictionary, they are beautiful works of art, incredibly beautiful, like poetic. The way definitions are written. Sorry to tangent, but it's something that I'm passionate about.
Yeah. So anyway, that's just another example of a thing where we used to have this expertise, and then it became unprofitable, and now we don't have the expertise anymore, and then something is lost. Now, look, the new way might be better in a lot of ways. It might be more accessible. You don't need to go to the library and look things up in a book anymore. Like there are things that are a lot better about the way that things are currently, but something's lost. Okay. Anyway. Rewind, way back to my original point, which is, so there's something about work that actually is meaningful beyond just the making of the money.
Yeah.
And also, in addition to what I just said, there is something about working in the 21st century that is uniquely dehumanizing, right? That takes away your humanity, that makes it so that it pits people against each other. It forces you to attach a lot of meaning to your work. And then so when you lose your job, you feel like you've lost your life's purpose, which is should be silly, but it's not, right? It's kind of just the way things are. People feel like their value is attached to their state of employment in today's economy. And that is vividly depicted in No Other Choice. Is that like many of the characters in No Other Choice have lost their jobs, and it's like, wow, they're struggling. They're driving their spouses mad with their
especially men.
Yeah, who like in these specific families historically have been the providers of their family, and so when they no longer have that role, they start to question what is their value in society, and they start to behave erratically. And I think this movie brings that out all very wonderfully. But you know, the core of the movie is about like this main character who decides that he needs to take extreme measures in order to be employed. And what is so great about this movie is that it kind of shows how much people are willing to sacrifice of their humanity in exchange for so little. Like, what he's trying to achieve, he's not like, I want to make $5 million dollars. Like, he's not trying to do something that's like outrageously aspirational. He's just like, I just want
a job, be a mid-level manager.
That is, that's somewhat similar to what I had before. It can even be lower. Like, I don't care. Mm-hmm. And the lengths to which he will go are taken to an extreme level that they are basically inhumane. And I think by being so over the top, it highlights how absurd and upsetting the modern workplace situation is. So
it's like the point of satire, I love this movie, right? Yeah. Is to be a little overcranked. This reminds me a lot of like Falling Down. You know, we don't like fully idolize Michael Douglas's character in Falling Down, but we understand his frustrations, and you understand why somebody could be pushed to the brink to respond to that. And like, you have complicated feelings about it because you understand where they're coming from. And that's how I kind of go into this movie. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I will just say I didn't feel myself rooting for this guy at any point.
Right. Right.
I was invested to know what would happen to him, you know, but I think that's different than like wanting him to succeed in any way. I think which is what I think the movie wanted me to feel is sad that he felt like he had to take these measures, right? Like,
because people at some points mentioned to him and the other man, like, you could do something else, you could get another job. And I'm like, no, I put all my experience points in this, and this is what I'm gonna do.
I put all my experience points, you know, I don't know how to do anything else, right?
Yes.
And that's kind of the rejoinder. But anyway, we have a lot more to talk about in spoilers, so let's talk about spoilers for No Other Choice starting right now.
I thought up an ending for my book.
It makes no damn sense.
Compels me, though.
I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end.
When I buy a new book, I always read the last page first. That way, in case I die before I finish, I know how it ends.
You can't handle the truth!
Inconceivable!
I came here to tell you how it's going to begin.
I want to say that the sequence when he confronts that guy with the gun in the oven mitt.
Yep.
Is...
pulls off multiple
one of
minutes.
The best sequences of 2025. Like, just the entire sequence of he has the gun in the oven mitt. The guy has no idea why he's pointing an oven mitt at him. There's a
the guy points his finger at him.
Yeah,
it's like a Mexican standoff.
He takes off the oven mitts and the other thing. And then there's a freaking, I think, like 80s Korean rock music playing in the background. The whole thing, the guys can't even hear or understand each other the whole time. And then this massive, messy fight ensues. It is a tour de force, by far my favorite thing out of the whole movie, of how messy and out of control and ridiculous and funny and terrifying it is.
When he shoots that guy in his body, the way his body moves after he shoots the shot, it's so great.
It's an incredible sequence, and I just wanted to highlight it as like one of my favorite things. I mean, it's a really sad, upsetting movie. You know, Jeff, to your point, like, it's a really sad, upsetting movie. I think, like, for example, I think if I'm reacting to what you, if I'm trying to like see what you how, your reaction, Jeff, is like. When he goes to the shoe salesman guy, it's like, did you have to make the shoe salesman guy like kind of that
so
sad?
So relatable? Yeah,
right?
So
like,
sad.
Oh, man.
It's like, it's so tragic, you know, that guy's dead. Because all he has a child.
Yeah.
He's just trying to sell some shoes, trying to make some, and of course he dies horribly. And,
it's awful. It's so awful.
Yeah, it's awful. Like, it's awful.
But, The thing that broke my heart more, I think, than any of even of that is, and I understand the point of all this. I understand why what the movie is saying, but is the family getting on board with his wife?
His wife gets on board, right?
Yeah. The most compelling character in this film for me is the wife.
Yeah.
I related. I watched this movie through the eyes of the wife, and I thought she was amazing. The performance is awesome, and her sort of breaking bad with him to me is the most heartbreaking part, is that she's willing to stand there and support it, knowing, like, you know, unable to deny the lie, or accept the lie any further and deny the truth of what's happening.
Right.
I think it's
this horrible thing that when you lose your job, you lose your dignity as well. And then by extension, his wife has lost a lot of her dignity as well. And then
that's
when
right.
you are reduced to that point, what are you willing to do? What are you willing to accept to get your dignity back? Right.
I mean, and, yeah, it's like, it's a beautiful, you know, her giving up the tennis lessons, you know, it's like, we don't need tennis lessons, but like, I understand as a husband, just how awful that would feel like, and her sort of selflessness. But the scene to me that was the most difficult was lying to the son and being like, it was a pig. Remember when we had that whole, that fun pig thing? Remember how we had the whole cookout with the pig? That's what dad was doing. Yeah, they're just doing another fun pig cookout at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah. The pragmatism of that character, I think, is just really fascinating because it's like, she doesn't want to give up her life either, right? But immediately once she learns things are tough, she's like, okay, here's a budget. We're losing Netflix. We're losing all that stuff. The dog's out of here. Like it's very much like, she's selling a bit of herself too, but it does make me think about the lengths we go to just have a comfortable life, you know, in modern society right now. It always involves sacrifice. I also think it's funny that, you know, this guy's plan, Lee Byung-hun's plan, is not necessarily like a great one. We don't know if these other guys are really going to be better than him in interviews, but
I mean, that's the most unrealistic part of the movie, other than the killing, is that in reality, many things factor into whether somebody gets a job, right? I don't know how it is in South Korea, but like in America, I've done many interviews for corporations, and it's like, there's many different factors that go into whether someone gets hired. It's not just like, do they have the best resume?
Although maybe this is such a niche field. He's like, oh, I know exactly who's going to be interviewing for this.
Well, like,
he
rates the resumes. He's like, A+, A.
Very
A-.
smart. You know, very, very well
He does it methodically. Right.
I have friends who have been out of work for years, who have gone on hundreds of job interviews, and nothing amounts to it. So it's not only that it's tough to be without your job. It's also like in this market with companies automating and streamlining and pushing more things to AI or whatever, they're not hiring as much, not as many roles are available. There is a sense of desperation right now among the working class, and I think this movie captures it. Yes, I don't advocate going out and murdering your competition, but also we are so strapped, like we're so in such a tough spot right now as a society. Is like, you can kind of understand why somebody who has been trying to do this for so long would just go to this insane route. Don't support it, but it's also, unfortunately, the crushing like maw of capitalism has pushed him to this point. It's sad.
I will say, Devendra, the movie could have done something with that. And what I mean by that is there is this open question of whether he's actually going to get the job at the end.
Yeah.
And it would have been interesting potentially if he did all this and then he didn't get the job, right? And and it's like, it actually doesn't matter what you do. Like, the movie could have been making this point about, like, it doesn't matter what you do. Like, you can't get the job anyway. But what the movie does instead is, and again, obviously we're in spoilers, he gets the job, only it's a way worse job than what he had before. He's essentially overseeing the destruction of his entire in field of expertise.
Yeah.
And there's a time limit on how long his job is going to last. And even that, he's like, yes, this is so
good. You did all of that for this empty.
Right. Love this. This
Pyrrhic
is so amazing.
Victory. Yeah.
You know, guys, there is one moment in this film that is extremely similar to a moment in Train Dreams. So extremely minor spoiler for Train Dreams, but there is a moment at the beginning of this film where he has the idyllic suburban life. Like, he's doing the cookout.
Beautiful
house.
Kids
are hanging out.
Incredible
house.
He's
got the dogs.
Yeah.
And then he hugs his family and he's like, you know what I'm thinking? I have everything. And there's a moment in Train Dreams where the Train Dreams about this rail worker. Mm-hmm. And he goes home and he has a kid and his wife in this cabin in the middle of the woods. And it's beautiful. And there's this narration that happens in the movie that says, you know, and for a brief time, so-and-so was at peace with this world. And, you know, it was the happiest, looking back, it would be the happiest time of his life. And and it made me realize, watching this movie and that movie that both came out in the last like 2 months, that like, maybe that's all we can hope for in life, right? Is that like, you get like a brief moment of happiness. And that's it. And it will never be that way again, you know? And like, because that is true in both films, where like the main character gets this brief sense of like, oh, this
it's
is
a
so
glimpse.
Good. And then it's and then it's never that way again.
And I love it's the way it's shot way in this movie too. It's like it is so saccharine. It's like a Hallmark movie right. moment too. Right. Like he's really cranking it up, but it's also like I would love to do this with my family at some point. Like even if it's like a little much. It's
even
also
if
like
literally everything that happens after that is hellish yeah. nightmare.
Yeah.
You know, it'd be nice to have that one thing. That one moment. Mm-hmm. Jeff, go ahead.
There's a psychological truth that I often think about way too often that I'm sure you guys know, but you know, it is about how we as human beings rely on storytelling, in that, you know, you can tell someone, you know, they had 50 years of being insanely happy, and then the last years of their life were horrible, awful, terrible. Or you can have 50 years of awful, horrible, terrible, but the last years of their life were absolute bliss. And people will believe that the latter is better. It's just mm-hmm. a reordering right. of events.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not about quantity of how long you had
right.
that was joyful and perfect and blissful. It's literally the order of the events that we as humans value most. And I find that too. Like this guy, you're right to point out, like he had it. It's just he didn't have it at the end, you mm-hmm. know? And that's
he had a shittier version of it at the end.
I'm not
right?
saying, yeah. you know, I'm just saying that the order of events was such that it's not palatable to us as humans. We want the ending of our lives yes. to be the blissful mm-hmm. part. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter what happened before,
right.
which is so crazy. You should as humans value amount of time spent in bliss, right? Amount of
right.
time where things were positive over just the order of events. But that's yeah. not how we work. It's pretty interesting.
I think it's because we like to think of things as narratives and stories, right?
That's
like,
right.
We like to conceive of our lives or other people's lives as a cohesive whole.
Right.
When in fact,
which is
it's much messier.
Absolutely arbitrary.
Right.
Thing to impose on it. You
right.
know,
like, it's like trajectory is somehow more important.
Yeah.
Than total amount of time spent in bliss and what have
yeah.
you. Yeah. It's an interesting phenomenon. But I'm trying to think of like here's the thing about this movie. There's so many wonderful moments, but it's really hard to actually describe them. You know, like
in this movie,
like like for instance, there's that moment when he and his wife are talking in the room after they've gone to the costume party, which is like very funny. Mm-hmm. The whole
costume party, also great scene.
But
also
then he's like,
hilarious. Yeah.
Then he says to his wife, "Do you know how hard it is to look somebody in the eye and do this?" And then he points a gun and pulls the trigger, and then the lights go on when
yeah.
he pulls the trigger. And then it's at that moment you realize his wife didn't see him like pull the trigger, because otherwise yeah. that would be really weird. You know, like, but it's like you have to see it to understand how yeah. brilliant that moment. You know, there's so many moments that are like that where it's like describing it is really hard, but there's so many moments where it's just like, wow, the magic of film, you know, is in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I also love the two cops that are investigating the everything and just like missing, whiffing so hard on so many, but they're so close to putting the pieces together.
That feels
know?
Like the subtext of every movie about Korean cops, because they're notoriously terrible.
Yeah. yeah.
Like yeah. Memories of Murder.
At yeah. least yeah. In Korean cinema. But yeah, I mean, it was like, hey, these two guys disappeared. And then he's like, yeah, I mean, I got so upset when they died. I heard they died. And he's like, we didn't say they died. We just said they disappeared. Like, interesting that you said that.
Anyway,
though.
Be careful, because somebody's out there gunning for you.
Ah, good times. All right. Any other thoughts on No Other Choice, guys? I thought it was wonderful. It's a must watch, in mm-hmm. my opinion.
It is a masterpiece of visual storytelling for sure. Yes.
I'm sorry, Warhol, it's welcome for you. You're not the first person that said that, Jeff. I think a lot of people are like, boy, this went on for a long time.
I just feel like if it yeah. ended a little mm-hmm. more ambiguously, it would have worked better for me. You know, and it's kind of what you were talking about like, oh, was the, you know, let the audience kind of sit with it, I think, more. And I think it just hammers its point a little too hard at the end, and I'm like, okay, I get it.
Because the end is he gets this, like, he gets the, like, really crappy version of the job, right? That's the end of it. Like, I found that to be a fairly satisfying ending.
I mean, you can end it any point earlier and have a different reaction, like have a different response to the movie. But I think specifically what they did here is, yes, he, all this work for nothing, really. And then we also end with, like, also, what are you doing here? Destruction of the environment. Like, what are we really, what are we really fighting for? Here for this industry.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think paper is the biggest problem, but I agree. Yeah.
It is. We need the trees. We do need trees.
Yeah.
More than ever.
But yeah, the idea that it's like such a crappy version of it and he's still overjoyed. That's a very powerful idea. That's a very powerful idea.
We do get the fan, like they got the dogs back and it's all, you know, copacetic at home. I don't know. I just
until,
felt you know,
but the thing is, the thing until is, like, his all that over. Is, until the next thing happens. And then,
and you know
and then what it is. What is it, right? Then what's going to happen, right? And
reminds me a bit of the end of The Shield, which we don't need to spoil here, but characters ending in purgatory is kind of fascinating to me because that is something we don't see very often. It's like, maybe you get a win, but you know it's not going to last. Mm-hmm. And that's interesting.
Oh, it's almost like the end of Marty Supreme.
Is it?
Yeah.
Pyrrhic we can victories. Have that conversation, but I'm done, tired, and talking about that movie.
All right. Well, anyway, those have been our thoughts on No Other Choice. And at the end of the day, it is really impressive that Park Chan-wook made a movie. That's going to bring us to the end of this week's episode of the Filmcast. Our theme song comes from Tim McKeown from The Midnight. Check out their new album, Syndicate. Our spoiler bumper and weekly plugs music comes from Noel Ross, who also edited this episode with video assistance provided by Kurt Mega and John Barry. Next week on the podcast, it's going to be 28 years later, The Bone Temple.
Amazing.
Guys, 28 years later, The Bone Temple. I mean, I know you've been reading reviews of this movie for the last 7 weeks since they screened it early for critics last month.
Very well, but, also like some audiences too in the UK. It wasn't just critics.
Around the world. Yeah.
I can't talk about this.
Invite must have got lost in the mail for that one, you know? So, like, I'm...
We got to say this movie like Randy Savage, right? The Bone Temple.
Yes.
That's how I'm thinking of it.
The Bone Temple's ready.
Yes.
Dave, I can't imagine something would get lost in the mail, what with you living in a different country now.
I got to tell you guys...
How could that possibly happen?
I got to tell you guys real quick. I know different dress is going in a couple minutes, but, like... When we came here, my wife said to everyone, do not send us anything. Do not mail us anything. Like, don't send any packages, no care packages. In general, if you live in Portugal,
we are dead to you.
You don't want anything you don't want anything unless it's already in the EU, right? Mm-hmm. And literally our neighbor disregarded that advice and sent us a container of like this wonderful Chex Mix, kind of holiday Chex Mix.
If it's edible, whatever.
Homemade, right? Cost her $50 to ship it to us. Oof. And you'd think, oh, well, then, sure, it's $50, but at least it gets to you. We did not get the Chex Mix. We got a letter in the mail that says, hey, we at Portuguese Customs have your Chex Mix.
And it's delicious.
And you need to log online and claim it and pay an additional VAT tax for it.
Oh, boy.
So we did that. Ended up paying an additional $25 to so basically it's like $75 Chex Mix.
Most expensive Chex Mix of all time.
Absolutely. So yes, don't send me anything, but if you're in the EU, I welcome your packages and your screening invites.
Your Chex
they
Mix.
Are Devinder Hardwar and Jeff Kanata. I'm David Chen. We'll see you next week for our review of 28 years later, The Bone Temple. Bye.